Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Ultimate Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined for the very first time live and in living color. He's literally 6 inches away from me right now, Nick Osello. A very happy, only slightly inebriated Nick Osello.
We have one microphone. We have two bald guys. We are sitting here watching Notre Dame cut down the rope. And here, I want to get ahead of this right now. I am going to do my best to try and be as unbiased and actually giving good takes as possible, but it's going to be very difficult. I was in the Notre Dame section the entire time. I was in the Notre Dame tailgate this morning. You might be able to hear my words slurring just a little bit, but sorry, I will not apologize because I'm so fired up about it, Terry.
We legitimately named this podcast The Tailgate so that we could drink and do it. So no, Nick, I am sober, unfortunately, but...
Yeah, me too.
We don't know what this podcast is going to hold in store, because after we finish this section, we're going to go walk around and see if we can run into some folks. It's the value of being in person together. But for those of you who are tuning in for the reasons that you always do, Notre Dame 15, Maryland 5, Fighting Irish, back-to-back national champions. Nick, why did Notre Dame win?
I was watching the game, trying to watch the game with a critical eye, trying to watch what Tillman was doing, you know, X's and O's. He's one of the big geniuses of the sport world. And to me, it just came down to watching a varsity team play a freshman team. And that's no disrespect to Maryland, because Notre Dame's depth, their athleticism, everything that Maryland did correctly, which was win the faceoff matchup, which was start the game hot, there were so many things that they did right in the first about 10 minutes. And it just seemed inevitable. It really did, because for how hard Maryland worked for their goals, for how hard that they made Notre Dame's defense work to get that 2-0 lead to start, it just seemed like every time Notre Dame got the ball, they were saying, okay, well, we have the talent and skill where not only do we have to take Ajax Zapatello out of the game by not initiating with him, but Riley Gray, but Jordan Faison, but Eric Dobson.
Will Angrick, who actually scored the first goal, yeah.
It just kind of blew my mind that no matter what Maryland did, Notre Dame just had the talent, had the athleticism, and had the X's and O's that Duke and Virginia didn't bring to the table to completely dominate the entire game. Am I wrong in that?
No, not at all. I think that there's a lot that I want to get to. First, let's just kind of set the scene.
Briefly, Final Four talk.
Well, just to say that Notre Dame beat Denver. I believe that score was 13-6.
Yep.
That sounds right. And then Maryland beat Virginia in the other semifinal, and I think that score was 10-4, maybe 11-4, somewhere in that neighborhood. This game felt very similar to the Denver game in that air of inevitability that you talked about, especially because of the other point you made, which was, it felt like Maryland was getting what they wanted with one lone exception. Logan McNaney did not make a save in the first half. He finished with 10 in the game. This is a former NCAA tournament most outstanding player. For me, it is very difficult to not assume that that's in his DNA and then kind of reel it back to a combination of the defensive performance that Maryland was able to put in place in front of him and the way in which that was offset, not just by the potency of Notre Dame's offense, but again, you kind of made this point already, the variability. Like, if taking Pat Kavanaugh out of the game, at one point he had 5 assists, I think he might have finished with 6, so they didn't take him out of the game, but if that just means that Jalen Seymour and Fisher Finley are going to score goals, how can you win?
What are you doing?
Yeah.
It was impossible, so like, watching where Maryland and Notre Dame were initiating from, what had me worried early on was Maryland was doing an objectively good job at making it a difficult matchup for Notre Dame's defense, in the sense that it wasn't the, oh, we're going to try and play bully ball like DU did, like a lot of the ACC opponents that Notre Dame did, where it's just we're going to get a full head of steam. What Maryland's done a really, really good job of, to the fact that they got to the national championship game, initiating from X, having off-ball movement, having the off-ball players have to make really good off-ball movements. And Notre Dame didn't essentially need to slide consistently throughout the entire game. And so, like, what I will consistently go back to is just a different class of athlete that Notre Dame has. And I'm really going to try and not be biased here, but it's just a different level of athlete that Notre Dame had. And that manifested itself in a couple different ways throughout the game. Offensively, we saw individual performances kind of make it impossible for Maryland to know when to slide to whatever. But Notre Dame's defense didn't really need to slide consistently throughout the entire game, which allowed them to put a premium on off-ball defense, which was Maryland's bread and butter. As we revisit Maryland-Virginia, we saw Virginia hung up at X and the off-ball movement simply crush Virginia throughout the entire game. And because Notre Dame didn't need to slide, the off-ball players had the luxury of saying, well, cool, like, you do whatever you want to do. I am just going to focus 100% on the off-ball movement. And when you're in that off-ball situation, like, even reflecting on my time as a player, it was always tough to prepare for the slide and watch C cuts from the crease and watch off-ball exchanges. They didn't have to worry about any of that. And I mean, I hope you can hear a little bit of the background. We hear the Notre Dame fans are still in the stadium at the link. The boys are wearing the national championship t-shirts as they cut down the net. And if you have one thing to complain about, and it's my voice being hoarse, shove it where the sun don't shine, sir or madam.
So we got to talk about Chris Kavanaugh, most outstanding player of the NCAA tournament, and put on an absolute show. And one of the things that you pointed out was the opposite of what Notre Dame was able to do in terms of locking down their defensive matchups. When Chris Kavanaugh got the ball, at some one point in the third quarter, he got twice switched onto a short stick. And I was really attentive to Colin Berlay's off ball in terms of, like, how he was trying to position himself, both to be able to go quickly, but then also to be able to try to occupy a little bit of interior space because of the fear that Kavanaugh was going to be able to go, get a step, have to draw. And then if he was going to be the one to go, he wanted to be big in order to prevent some of that interior space, particularly if it was going to be filled by Jake Taylor, to, you know, kind of yield an easy goal, which was, I think, a function of the way in which the second goal was scored. Because the air of inevitability was a function of a variety of things. But one of them, your point, was the ease with which Notre Dame scored the goals. I would argue the easiest goal they scored on the day was the second goal, when there was a miscommunication and Taylor was completely open on the doorstep and he just finished for a dunk on the crease. Once that happens, I mean, I think that it's probably true that most defensive coordinators are most concerned about Taylor, because when he goes supernova, it really raises the level of Pat and Chris. If he gets one like that, then all six defenders start to get, like, really nervous about, like, oh no, how is this going to go? How is this going to unfold? And I think that, again, you know, there were so many factors that kind of had that compounding effect to it, that it was just... The way I was preparing for this game was Maryland's path to victory was so narrow. They were going to have to, you know, do a number of things well. And to your point, they did a number of things well. They faced off well. They were going to need to control the tempo. They were going to need to get complementary scoring. They were probably going to have to get scoring outside of the 6-on-6. Maybe, you know, against Duke, we talked about, they got four goals, two off the faceoff, two in transition, that and then one empty net goal that made that, you know, 14-goal total that they scored. It was really kind of 9 in normal offense. Big number. They probably weren't going to be able to get that against the Notre Dame defense. And so what that meant is that they were going to have to keep Notre Dame's total in that, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 range. And once you're giving up empty goals to Jake Taylor alone on the crease to make it 2-2, you know, at that point it's like, all right, I don't know how we're going to keep this team under 10 or under 11.
Well, and so Chris Kavanaugh was the MVP of the game, but I am firmly on the side that Liam Enemann needs to win the Tewarton this year. Not only did he hold a very potent Maryland offense who had absolutely pumped Princeton, had beaten Duke, had beaten UVA with new looks, and credit to Tillman. I do want to give Tillman his just desserts, because the way that he structured and changed the Maryland offense from where they were at the end of the season to the first game in the tournament is unprecedented. The fact that you can change and completely put something new on film and have it look like they've been running that all year was my number one worry this year. And we talk about the ease with which Notre Dame was able to score and the difficulty with which with Maryland having to manufacture goals and do this. And to me, when I really felt like Notre Dame was going to run away with it, was it was a probably 2-2 or 3-2 game. It was a one-goal game early on. And Eric Dobson was able to get to his left hand. And
oh,
say,
you
like,
love when Eric Dobson gets to his left hand.
I love Dobson so much. He is the left-handed version of me where it's just like, hey, I'm bigger and faster and stronger. I'm not going to make a great pass. I'm not going to make a great read. I'm just going to bully my way and end up scoring. And Maryland was unable to be a threat from outside because after the first two or three goals were let in by Entman, he got red hot. And it made Maryland's offense have to figure out ways to try and just like we were talking about and say, well, we're going to force it into the crease. We're going to have to dodge towards where we're going to be able to score from that 5-on-5 or that 5 and 5 yards. We're going to have to score from the top of the crease. And when Notre Dame can just kind of say, let's give up those outside shots and defend the middle of the field with 80% of our effort, there's nothing that Maryland can do, especially when the one-on-one defense from Notre Dame was absolutely exceptional from the start of the whistle to the very end.
A couple things that we should point out in terms of how the things that Maryland did well, and we already, you know, kind of talked about it, but we should say his name, Luke Wehrman, won 17-24.
Great performance from Wehrman.
I mean, the way that Joe Sanliquido, who's going to write the story about Luke's performance today, put it when we were discussing the ideas that he was talking about is he said he went out on his shield. And it really did kind of feel like that. For a guy who, you know, so much about the way that his 2022 season was defined was a function of the way his 21 season ended with that fateful last-second shot in a one-goal game in the national championship against Virginia, and then he turned into a first-team All-American the following year. You know, it really did feel like a fitting performance as he tried to carry his team over the finish line, you know, when ultimately it was just one of those things where there wasn't much to be done because of the talent deficit. One of the other elements of Maryland that I want to discuss is I came away from their win over Virginia most interested in how they were going to clear the ball against Notre Dame because John Tillman in his post-game press conference was most interesting or compelling and provided far more detail when discussing scouting Virginia's ride in the quarterfinal against Johns Hopkins than he was at any other point in his session. And he talked about how they rode against Hopkins so differently, and he didn't know whether that was a reflection of what they did when they put Kyle Morrison in goal as opposed to what they saw out of Hopkins personnel that they wanted to try to exploit. And he, as a result, didn't know what that meant about how they were going to try to ride him. Maryland was excellent in their clear against Virginia. I think they failed 2 clears, whereas Hopkins failed 9 against Virginia in the week prior. Notre Dame comes in. They were so they all season long, and really for the last 3 years, they have been so closely associated with their ride, particularly led by Pat and Chris. And one of the elements that I was, you know, kind of more mindful of is what's the gap between the tactics versus the effort? Effectively, what does Notre Dame want to try to do? So they're a drop ride. They want to play you at the midline, and they want to be able to cause those turnovers with checks at the midline. That is so much from where Pat and Chris's effect comes from, especially against a settled clear as opposed to, you know, a clear off a turnover or something along those lines. And I thought that it was very interesting, particularly early. Maryland was so reluctant to try to test anything at the midline. If you were a short stick and you thought you were going to absorb contact, you were pulling back, you were working the ball through Logan McNaney, and he was trying to clear box side, and then they were very content with having to throw like a 40-yard pass, a looping pass over the midline, basically half field to half field, and it worked. They got out to a really good start clearing the ball, 5-5 in the first quarter. They were turning the ball over too much in their own offensive end. They finished 19-for-22 on the clearing game overall. You know where that didn't necessarily work out? Is that Notre Dame cleared 26-27. and Maryland doesn't ride. So they weren't able to get any of those additional possessions. Obviously, they won the faceoff advantage, so they were, you know, they had the ball enough in order to be able to produce if they could get anything, if they could be efficient offensively or defensively, and they just weren't. But it was really interesting to see how they were going to attack those two elements of the game, because they've, you know, I think they would have come in assuming that they were going to be less efficient, at least at the offensive end of the field, so they were going to have to make up those possessions. They didn't try to ride. They tried to get those possessions in the faceoff game. They got them, but it wasn't nearly enough to be able to overcome what the Fighting Irish brought to the table.
Well, and if you're a fan of the tailgate, like, you probably have heard me talk about how big of a nightmare it was to game plan against the Whip Snakes when I was playing in the PLL, because they were so efficient. Like, that's the number one word that comes to mind with a difficult game plan, is like the 2021 Whip Snakes. They could push in transition, they could clear effectively, they were good on offense, they were good on defense, they had a good goalie. And it just seemed, what was a little interesting to me was exactly what you just pointed out, where if Maryland wanted to win the game, you have to have that balance between playing conservatively and trying to chew up a good amount of the shot clock, you're winning the faceoff matchup, but not so conservatively that you're not willing to push it in transition and try and manufacture those goals. Because what Notre Dame did on the ride, which I thought was very interesting, was not put so much pressure on GLE and just kind of be content with dropping back a little bit and making them make those passes pretty consistently, almost just conceding the bad passes up top to say, we're going to make you try and make these passes, but we're not going to concede anything in the ride. But there were a couple opportunities when Maryland could have pushed it early on. It could have changed the tempo of the game, but they were more putting a premium on let's control the tempo and slow things down and try and eat the shot clock up, which that's a game plan that I can't argue against going into a team like Notre Dame. But at the same time, have the green light in the first 10 seconds after you clear it so that you can manufacture those goals and try and make it a closer game, because they were just outgunned 6-on-6.
Let's pull it back a little bit as the Notre Dame team starts to clear the field, and we're going to try to get down and maybe catch some of these interviews post-game. Also, we got a shout-out, Brock Behrman, who...
Big shout-out.
You might not know, obviously, if you follow recruiting in high school lacrosse, you would know him, really highly touted player, but hasn't contributed that much, hasn't gotten on the field that much yet in his Notre Dame career. Did you see this? Took a flying piece of equipment to the scalp and ended up bloodied and with his entire head wrapped in. I mean, he looked like a dog, like one of those cartoon dogs who, like, either has a toothache or is, like, just got home from the vet.
With the big mercury temperature gauge.
Correct. Yeah. So this is always one of the, like, most interesting and revealing moments of the season, the dynamics. Like, who are the guys that just can't bring themselves to leave the field? Who are the ones that are like, this is cool, but, yeah, I want to go grab a sandwich or whatever. It's just,
yes,
there's
a sandwich. Yeah. Nice one.
There's a lot to be studied from this moment in time. But let's quickly hit on the semifinals. I'm assuming you remember them. They happened about 36 hours ago. This is your first Final Four as a fan, correct?
Yeah.
What do you think?
First Final Four. I mean, I'm out here doing guerrilla marketing for Second Slide. Not really a fan, but absolutely a fan. The crowds were awesome. I mean, to be a part of that environment, and, like, you know, you remember it as a player, and a lot of times you just kind of gaslight yourself into thinking that the fans, the energy, the crowd were bigger than they were. And so I have these memories.
Well, you also don't really have the perspective. I mean, you're still, like, there's a wall between you and the fans, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can see and hear it, but, like, number one, you're focused on something other than the fans, and number two, like, you're not in it.
No. And so, like, you look up on the field and you just see a good section filled out in green, and you're like, hey, thanks everybody for coming out. But to be in that environment and to hear, and you even tweeted it out as we look at the picture of, oh my God, took a helmet to the dome. And as his team was celebrating, Mandy Merritt, shout out Mandy Merritt, who's the mother of the lacrosse and the trainer for Notre Dame, she was like stitching him up and putting gauze on his head. And that's just one of the funniest videos ever. But to be in the environment and hear the energy, and credit to Maryland's tailgate, which I was a part of on Saturday morning, unbelievable turnout. I mean, who else but us? Who else but having a tailgate podcast where we can go down and see the energy from all the fans? What an unbelievable weekend. And this is going to become a staple of my life for the foreseeable future. How much fun is this?
So Notre Dame 13, Denver 6. And I think we really just got to shout out Will Lynch. 18 to 23 at the faceoff X. Really tilted the scales in favor of the Irish. You know, it was similar in terms of, you know, the Pios kept it close for a little while. And they were getting what they... What they weren't necessarily getting what they wanted, quote unquote. What they were... I think what I'm trying to say is... The game was unfolding in a way that was in alignment with what they would have wanted the game, or how they would have wanted the game to unfold. But ultimately, the tsunami wave hit, and that was it.
And it, I feel like that was the story, was DU and Maryland started off with the picture-perfect start to have the type
and so
of
did
game,
Albany.
And so did Albany. To have the type of game where you could upset Notre Dame. And it just felt like late first quarter or at the start of the second, consistently through the tournament, it just felt inevitable. But the way that Maryland got into the championship game was a much more fascinating story to me because of those changes that we were talking about earlier. And I will give Tillman credit once more with how good he did at putting a season's worth of film completely behind him to completely change how he was running offense. And Virginia's defense, I will talk a little smack on them because they just were completely outgunned and outmatched, specifically on the off ball, specifically with how dangerous those Maryland players were 1 yard from the goal on top of the crease.
Yeah, too many instances in which guys got lost off ball, and it, you know, it was kind of inexplicable, not inexplicable, almost inexcusable, because they were situations where the ball carrier did not win his matchup, right? So it wasn't as if this was massive motion on the backside that was just hard to track. This was kind of normal, functional, like, we're just doing off-ball action behind the play, and you're losing track of us.
And there's, the, you know, it wasn't even that Virginia was sliding. That was the part that absolutely blew my mind, watching that Maryland-Virginia game. And what was nice is, you know, I was down in the nuts of the student section. Well, student section, but the fan section for Notre Dame for the first game. And when I was watching Maryland, Virginia, I was up top, which is a great angle to just kind of see the X's and O's. Like, you feel like Belichick kind of watching film in a sense. And every time Maryland was on offense, I was like, this is pretty simple off ball. And the way that I was trying to explain it to a fan that, you know, knew who I was, obviously. They were like, big fan of your work. And I'm like, no. But the crazy part to me was, like, Virginia was ready to play kind of like a DU bully ball, where it was like, okay, they're going to try and do this one-on-one matchup, this and that. And they were kind of just sitting there ball watching, expecting the ball carrier for Maryland to do something crazy, losing sight of their man, and very basic, like, C-cut, pick, stuff that you learn about in high school be so effective in a national semifinal. It kind of blew my mind. And I feel like Virginia blew it from the very beginning.
Well, and that was kind of where I was going to go, is that I think that if you – so the final was 12-6. Totally messed that up at the beginning. But I also felt like, you know, the game felt over with 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. And it felt like Maryland was going to be able to conserve some energy for a game that was going to be on a two-day turnaround. And part of it was because – it didn't feel like Virginia had a plan B after Connor Schellenberger was going to be neutralized by Ajax Apatello, which is something that has been a storyline for the last 3 years. And it happened again, and it was just a meaningful outcome. And the Cavaliers were as lethargic or lacking verve, spunk, whatever, as I can recall them really ever being under Lars Tiffany. And it was just a bad day to have a bad day, and they just didn't show up.
And not only did they not show up, but to your point, what Coach Byrne, his word, when he was a defensive coordinator at Notre Dame, and I still think he's the greatest coach of all time, but he was always doing a good job gauging how urgent you need to be, whether it's with the slide, whether it's pushing transition. Like, you know, we were a part of a couple games, you know, the 2014 quarterfinal against Albany, where when you're down, there needs to be a sense of urgency with everything that you do. And it just seemed like Virginia was deflated from the very beginning of the game, where once Maryland jumped out to a lead, they have the players. Like, it's Virginia. They have absolute stallions, but they're not pushing transition. They're not trying to manufacture goals. It kind of, you know, again, that's the biggest head scratcher of this season for me, is how Virginia handled that semifinal matchup with a lack of urgency when the entire season is on the line. Blows my mind. And no, you know, no offense to any Virginia fans out there, whatever, but you got to play with some balls coming into the semifinal.
Yeah, I'm sure that they watch it and are feeling the exact same way. And it's disappointing, but it's sports, right? You can't – that's why you play the game. And sometimes, you know, Virginia was favored, right? And so it is very fair to say, like, the team that folks expected to see is not the team that arrived. But, Nick, the field is completely cleared. Let's go find some people to talk to.
Let's do it.
All right, we are now in the bowels of Lincoln Financial Field with everybody's favorite player, Jake Taylor. Nick, you get the first question for Jake. What is it?
Who do you think is the best player from Denver to play at Notre Dame?
Nick Osello.
Wrong. It's you. Oh, my goodness. Okay, ask a real question.
How'd that game go and compared to what you expected?
I mean, we were game planning, obviously, for only 2 days, so we knew that we had to come out and give our best and perform. We used our depth well. We were able to dig deep into guys that didn't play as much throughout the year, but we had the depth this year to do things that were great, and we went out there and we played great.
We talked about this in the first part of the podcast, but basically just the complimentary scoring was obviously going to be a big deal, particularly it usually is in a championship game. You're coming on short rest and everything like that. You guys were already an outlier historically with your third midfield, and you saw it perform today. But on top of that, when a second goal is, you're wide open on the crease, and you know there's a miscommunication in Maryland's defense, and you finished. I think at that point it was just one of those things where it was like, oh man, how is Maryland going to keep Notre Dame off the board? What did that goal kind of do for you guys in terms of, now it's even 2-2, right? We kind of withstood their first punch. We'll see what happens next.
Yeah, so obviously they came out hot. They kept us on our toes a little bit at first, but I mean, we answered well, we responded well, and our guys dug deep and our defense played phenomenally. And that moment is obviously a great turning point that gives us a little bit of the momentum back that we were struggling with in the first few minutes. But moments like that are big, and then we had moments like that all throughout the game, offensively, defensively, and every goal means something going into that, especially when our defense is able to hold them to only five. So once we get past the point of where we're struggling in the beginning, we move on and we keep going up from there.
Well, and my question is more X's and O's wise, because Ajax Apatello, a game changer, and it seemed like going into it, you were just saying, we're fine initiating from a number of other spots. Like, we're not even going to let him impact the game. How intentional was that?
I mean, I think a big thing that we're fortunate enough to have the guys to do is to run at all six of the guys on the field, except for whoever is guarding me, because I'm not much of a dodger. But I think we're fortunate enough to have enough weapons that we can run at any of the guys on the field. We can match up well against any single person, whether it's any defender, any D-mid, any guy on the field at once. All of our Dodgers can go at any guy with full confidence, with full go, and there's a lot of intention behind what we do and how we practice, in that we don't see matchups as a factor to the best of our abilities. We see a defender in our way, and the guys on our team tend to just go hard at the net, and that's something I'm really grateful for, especially as an off-ball player, having guys who don't mind who they're going against.
And how bad did you want that between-the-legs, absolute scumbag shot against DU to go in? Because if that went in, I would have started a riot in the parking lot.
You know, every shot you shoot, you hope it goes in.
That's
so.
Right, baby, that's right.
Didn't go that time, but that's okay. It is what it is. Came out with a dub and came out with the win today, so that's all that matters.
So how does this win compare to last year?
It's different. I mean, obviously coming off of Coach's 35th year, I believe, last year, and that was his first one. It was very emotional, and we were the underdog in the Final Four last year. So going into moments like that, you know that your back's against the wall and you have to rise to the occasion to some extent. But also a big principle we have is just playing our game and playing us, picking up the next ground ball, winning the next faceoff, scoring the next goal. And we're a play-by-play team. We're not goal-oriented. We're not looking at, hey, we need to go win the natty. We're going at, we need to go win the first faceoff or win the next faceoff or score the next goal and make the next play. And that's the big thing that Corrigan preaches. So this year, obviously, it was the same mentality going into the game. And obviously the result, we felt good going in. We felt confident. Coach Corrigan preached confidence over arrogance, and that's something that we rode with the entire season. And obviously early on losing to Georgetown, that was kind of a kick in the nuts, but that was a really big turning point in the year for us, just no matter how early it was. And we were able to just make plays all throughout the year and keep it going up all year long.
So that was an important game to show you that you were vulnerable. It wasn't a preseason or a fall scrimmage against Princeton where like half the roster wasn't even dressed. It was, if we don't take this seriously, like we're vulnerable. And then, so is it fair to say that maybe there's like an extra satisfaction knowing that you were the one that everybody was focused on? You couldn't sneak up on anybody. There's no mitigating this. There's no excuses. Like, no, we were the best team this year.
Yeah, I feel confident that we were. I felt that all year long. I knew going in that we would have to prove ourselves. And obviously the loss of Georgetown definitely was a bit confusing in that we thought we were going to be really good, and that definitely led to some questioning within. But going after that, just using that as the fuel to build the fire that we needed for the rest of the year, was we really didn't let that stop us, and we were just consistently fueling that. And I mean, there was no doubt in any of our minds that we were capable of being the best team, and there was no doubt in any of our minds that we were the best team.
Big fan of your work. I love you. I'm so glad you went to Notre Dame and not DU. And that's how we're going to wrap up this.
Well, no. Hold on.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Okay, hold on. One more from the professional.
Yeah, well, it's because you're coming back.
Yeah.
And Chris Kavanaugh is now a most outstanding player of the NCAA tournament. He is coming back as well. On the broadcast, they talked about how ACC teams are going to graduate so much talent. And yet, you know, this Fighting Irish team is not going to be content to just say like, oh, yeah, we're defending champions, but, you know, we graduated a lot, so maybe we're not going to be that good next year. What do you think?
I mean, we graduated a good amount of guys, but we have a plethora of young guys who are ready to put in, who have been putting in work and are ready to put in work and get us going for next year. I mean,
who should win the Tewarton this year? He's a goalie.
I think Liam Entman is my favorite player to watch right now. He's been outstanding this year, and obviously, I think Pat Kavanaugh deserves it as much. And if they could give it to two guys, I mean, this would be the year to do it. We haven't seen two guys from one team since the Thompson brothers. So,
if you had to choose one,
I mean,
he already did.
No.
Yes, he did.
He kind of like threw, well, like both of these guys. I want you to choose one, and I want whoever you don't choose to give you a hard time about this later. You got to choose one, Entman or Kavanaugh.
There's so much at stake here in terms of team dynamics. Like the goalie I shoot on every day or the guy who throws me the passes that I score goals with?
I mean, obviously, we have the best goalie in the world and the best attackman in the world.
Don't give us this. Choose one.
We have two of the most impactful players in the world running for it. I think they both deserve it.
Choose one. I will outwait this awkward silence. I have nowhere to be.
It's not true. He has a flight in 84 minutes.
I don't know. I don't like answering this question.
You know what? I'll get this offline. We'll edit it into the podcast. And if he doesn't answer, then I'll just lie.
We'll just pick whatever one we want him to pick, and we'll just splice one of his saying his name into it. Yeah. Oh, man. Congrats, man. We appreciate it, Jake. And the Inside Lacrosse Tailgate Podcast continues with Notre Dame head coach Kevin Corrigan, 2-time national champion. Congratulations, KC.
Yeah, thanks, man. That sounds good.
What do you attribute the outcome to?
That's tough because, honestly, like, we played really well for the majority of this season. We really feel like we consistently came out week in and week out and played well and made ourselves a tough out, you know. So I think it starts with that. You know, we weren't the kind of team to be in sloppy games and let people make a lot of plays that they didn't earn. That kind of thing, you know, that kind of a little bit of a mantra of ours as we went through the year is just make them earn it, you know. If they're going to score a goal, make them earn it, you know, because we know how good Enty is and we know how athletic we are defensively and feel like, you know, if we don't get out over our skis too much, then teams have to really work to make plays, you know. And that talks to the defensive side. Offensively, we just had a lot of pieces and we had those special pieces that affect the way everybody plays, you know. I mean, I just was saying that, you know, I think offense is a little bit of a chicken and egg thing, right? You know, if you have good feeders, you somehow develop better cutters. When people start cutting well, your Dodgers dodge better because they have a little more space and a little more opportunity to do that. And then when they do that, then your feeders get the ball in better spots, and then they're more effective, and it just goes like that, right? And so, you know, I think that's a real thing. And I think having Pat Cavanaugh be that guy who can do those things and deliver those balls, and then having pieces like Jake Taylor inside, Chris is not just a Dodger, but a shooter and a very much improved passer this year. And then, you know, Eric Dobson, who, listen, if Eric Dobson wanted to score three goals every game, he would score three goals every game. Eric Dobson wants us to win, so he does whatever it takes for us to win. And I don't think people appreciated how much of his game he sacrificed to make sure that we played great offense, not that Eric Dobson got goals. And so, you know, when you have guys like that, and then you throw in a great athlete like Jordan, or, you know, super clever, smart finisher like Devin, you know, and then, you know, the pieces just start to fit together. And, you know, long answer, but I think that all of that stuff was a big part of kind of who we became over the course of the year.
Well, for the record, I was on the Dobson train from the very beginning. I was like, just a big, strong guy who can shoot and maybe do a little bit else. That's my kind of guy right there.
Yeah, but he became much more than that. That's my whole point, is he became a very good feeder. He became he probably went to the defensive end more than anybody on our midfields, right? In terms of, you know, killing transition and being able to either stay there and play defense or sub effectively and do those things. So I think, you know, his ability to do a lot of different things, not just be a big strong lefty shooter, is what made our team better, not him.
Well, he's a better man than myself, I'll tell you that. I'll tell you that right now. And so one of the things, like, you know, kind of throughout the entire year, there were certain moments where it was like, okay, the defense is great, the transition is great, the attack is great, the goalie is speaking for itself. Was there a piece of this team that you felt you could build around, or did it just change every week where you're like, we could win at any spot on the field? I mean, it had to be fun as a coach.
Yeah, it was fun. It wasn't something where we felt like, okay, we've got to score 14 this week because I don't think we can defend these guys.
Right.
You know, any more than it was we've got to hold these guys to 8 because I don't think we can get to 10. You know, and when you don't have to ever have either one of those thoughts, it's a pretty good thing, right? You know, you just feel like, hey, you know, let's just play. And you know, it seemed to be enough, you know. And listen, to be a really good defensive team, you have to be a smart offensive team to keep yourself out of transition. You saw that when we kind of got sloppy late in the game, and all of a sudden they're getting these jailbreak fast breaks, and you're like, all right, you know, let's calm down over here, you know. You know, so one complements the other, right? You know, if you want to be a great defensive team, you have to be a good riding team. You have to be a smart offensive team. You can't take bad shots that lead to transition and that kind of thing. And if you want to be a great offensive team, you can't spend, you know, all day, you know, playing defense because your defense isn't stopping people or losing faceoffs, you know, and you're on the short side of the possession game all day, right? So our team, we had a very complete team this year, and you know, Will Lynch's development as a faceoff guy is a big part of that. The ability for Sean Light to come in and play at the level that he did,
unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with two experienced guys flanking him, which was awesome. You know, two fifth year guys who did a great job in keeping him. But boy, if you'd have told me before the year that he was going to play at the level he did all year long, I would have. Even after watching him and thinking he's terrific, I would have been hard-pressed to think he was going to play that well throughout the year.
Well, I'll let Terry finish up, but on behalf of me, Matt Landis, Eddie Glazner, Hugh Krantz, John Sexton, Max Pfeiffer, Brian Buglione, we had all the alumni out, and we just wanted to say collectively, congratulations. This is so cool, full circle moment for me to be on the press team talking to you after a national championship.
Thanks. Congratulations. Thank you,
brother. And then if he wants to ask an actual question.
Well, yeah, I'll see whether or not, because you demurred when Kark asked on the broadcast about contextualizing last year versus this year, so I'm not going to ask about that. But I am going to ask about, so last year, one of the things that made it unique was that it was the first time. This year, what made it unique is that you were the team that everybody was hunting. You were the target. Is there something that is a, I don't want to call it more satisfying, but it does it feel like a culmination of a career's worth of effort to get to the point where the combination of the quality of everybody involved and their commitment to the way you believe the process should go actually worked?
Tremendously gratifying. But last year was tremendously gratifying. But this whole year, you know, being able to celebrate with our alums, all the people that contributed to getting our program to a certain point, and did make us competitive at the highest level for a while. It's been great to celebrate that first one with them. This second one, let's put it this way: we won it last year. I wouldn't stand on a soapbox and say we were the best team. Right. I would say we won the championship, and good on us. We were the best team this year,
right.
and that's gratifying in its own way, right? To have a team that we weren't the best team because we got hot at the end or because of something else. We came up week in and week out. We came up, you know, spades when we needed to, and that's tremendously gratifying, you know. So yeah. It's different. It does feel different. It's weird. It's awesome, but it's definitely different than last year.
Well, congrats. Enjoy the celebration. We look forward to seeing you again next year.
Yeah, damn right, buddy. Yes. We'll be back.